Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour podcast following week four in the Premier Lacrosse League. I'm Kevin Brown alongside Chris Rosenthal. Rosie, we've got a special episode yet again this week following some exciting action. 2-1-goal games in Charlotte, a couple blowouts. Philadelphia has arrived. How we doing? What you thinking? What's going on over there, Rosie?
Once again, the league keeping us all on our toes, and we have it no other way.
No other way, indeed. And I think there's a very clear explanation for all of that, and we're going to get into some themes, some standings talk, maybe, perhaps. When you're adding games to the schedule, there's going to be some bumps along the road that come with it. And when those bumps, not really from a league perspective, but from an individual team perspective, you're going to have some difficulties adjusting to the early season roster, player movement adjustments that every GM and head coach has had to deal with so far. And when you're not practicing every day, and when there's so many new players coming in every game, every weekend, then you're going to have a lot of inconsistency and a lot of volatility coming in. And that's what we've seen. I think all four underdogs. I think Philly probably was favored against Boston. I'm not big into the betting odds, but the first three winners, I think, were certainly underdogs in Charlotte, as Utah defeated Carolina, then California over New York, and then Denver losing to Carolina. I think those three were all underdogs. Philadelphia could have been, after they were a 14-goal loser to the Boston Cannons just two game weeks ago. Craziness, Rosie. Craziness.
Very true. And just for official record, because I just looked it up here, although they certainly could have been, the good people at DraftKings expected the Water Dogs to get some payback this past weekend. Had them as the favorites.
And for good reason, there was no CJ Kirst when they first met, and there was no Kyle Lewis when they first met. And guess what? Both of them looked absolutely electric in this one, Rosie. CJ Kirst toe-dragging over past everyone, just such a bruiser when he kind of gets gets downhill and scores in between three guys. And listen, like, his exaggerated leaners when, like, he is looking, like, straight down and then throws the top shelf. Poor older brother Colin in net stood no chance for the shooting gallery he had to face out there. Boston is reeling. We'll get to that. Let's focus on the positive with Philly. How impressive were they in this just absolute 17-10 onslaught? That was 15-3 at one point in that third quarter.
Yeah, they were kind of what you think when you take a look at that roster. You know, once I guess we had gotten through the draft period, you start looking at it and you're like, oh man, they have this guy and that guy and that guy, right? And it just kind of starts building and you're like, you know, they should put up goals no problem every single weekend, right? You know, not saying, oh, they should always be 10 up on their opponent, you know, because, you know, obviously it's a difficult league and you never know any given weekend, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, if you show somebody this roster and you say, yeah, they just dropped 17 goals, you know, you got to probably get a reaction like, yeah, that seems reasonable.
Yeah, like reading Quint's power rankings up on insidethecross.com, if you want to go read them. Like, Silas Richmond, Matt Collison still waiting in the wings, getting their Canadian visas figured out. Like, you have just such an absolutely loaded offensive personnel that there's so many matchup problems for every defensive opposition. Like, whoever you short stick is just going to feast. And this week it was Kyle Lewis making just an absolutely electric debut. There's no other way to describe it with that absolute explosive couple of first steps out of those dodges, his split moves, his playmaking, that BTB look, the Kieran McCardle. I know he wants that one back. The BTB for his first ever shot going five hole from Sowers. Like, Rosie, his team is a problem.
I wish there was a way to track, like, the number of fans somebody has, because I would have loved to see the number of people who considered themselves Kyle Lewis fans prior to that game and then after that game. You know, because I love the – he kind of shows up with this sort of mythology to him, right? Because, you know, yeah. Certainly some people do know about him, but he's also kind of he's kind of off the books, right? You know, Adelphi, you've heard tales, but a lot of people maybe like, oh, you know, saw him, you know,
right. Like, he's really dodging against or some D2.
Exactly, right. He's like, well, I guess that'll fly down there. Maybe that's okay. And then, you know, he just steps on the field pretty much no time at all to, you know, it's not like he's, you know, takes a while to figure it out. Or, you know, he's not kind of playing humble, you know, oh, let me just pass it to these other guys who've won all this stuff. You know, it's Zach Currier here, you know, here, sir, you take the ball or anything like that. He was just like, you know, OK, I'm open. You know, Michael Sowers hits him from X. It goes behind the back five hole, just like right off the bat. What an introduction. You know, you've probably heard the name. And, you know, you've heard of kind of the urban legend Mystique, and here I am just kind of delivering like that. And like you mentioned, the pass to McCardle, just I feel like it's one thing to shoot a behind-the-back shot, because that's a lot more, in my opinion, you know, something like you've learned, okay, I need to increase my angle, X, Y, and Z. I feel like it's a little bit different from a mental approach, but just the way he whipped that behind the back pass over full stride, you know, doesn't miss a beat and just hits McCardle with it. You know, some of that feels like something that only comes with a degree of comfort, you know, when you're out there. So, you know, I asked him after the game and he did mention, you know, oh, you know, obviously I had, you know, some pregame jitters, you know, it being my first time and everything, but it did not look at all like he was nervous one bit being out there.
No, he looked like he belonged, and he's not going to miss that lineup again if he continues to play like that, because he played with a ton of confidence matched up against those short sticks. I do want to shout out the short sticks for Philadelphia. You mentioned Zach Currier. He played more of a short stick defensive midfielder role alongside Charlie Hayes and Matt Witcher, who were just outstanding against the Cannons midfielders. I think this game really mirrored that first meeting in terms of Boston was this time. They didn't see a lot of the ball early, got out of hand in a hurry, and they were hitting pipes when they were getting the ball. So pretty unlucky for them, and a much better fight back to get into the game. Down 15-3, like I mentioned, the get within 16-10. I had a chance to draw up like a 2-point play or something. That didn't go well. Rosie, do you think, before we get to Boston's issues, Philly might rue the fact that they let the opportunity go to make up such like a minus 14 score differential when they were up 12?
Yeah, you know, maybe. It would be funny to look back in a little while and think about how they, you know, are kicking themselves for only winning by a touchdown, you know? But it's so rare and so difficult to get these wins. And, you know, we always see this point, you know, score differential affect things one way or another down the road. So, yeah, you know, as wild as it is to say that about a 17-10 game, you know, kind of a bookmark this one because, you know, stranger things have happened later on in the season, so it might come back to haunt them.
Boston, there are a lot of things to discuss with this 1-3 start. The Ashton-Alting situation, we and all across talking heads have talked about in terms of Brian Kelly now fulfilling that ex-attackman role. Not a great performance again from him this game, but Rosie, what are your current takes on where Boston could go from here? Now, just not a great situation all around.
Yeah, and it's tricky because, you know, look, obviously the season's only so long, right? There's not that many games where you can experiment. But on the other hand, I'm sure Brian Holman doesn't want to keep making sweeping changes and, you know, give it two games or something and then say, okay, you know what, never mind, let me go back to this and kind of throw off all the chemistry you're building or trying to build.
Yeah.
I feel like he was pretty insistent of, you know, I like my lineup. I think we have the guys we need to get it done out there. You know, like you did mention Brian Kelly, it wasn't their first matchup. You know, I guess they had their scout on Brian Kelly this time around.
Totally.
Yeah, 0-3, three turnovers for him, no points in the game. I think, you know, time is obviously the huge concern, but if I'm Brian Holman, I don't know how much I immediately change. If I had to bet, I would guess maybe Ashton-Alting goes protected roster in their next game. I don't know if he comes back, but I also
to
don't
avoid losing him for free. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to avoid him just walking altogether. But I think at a certain point, you know, if you are Brian Holman and you do believe in the squad you have, you know, there's sometimes going to be bad games, or, you know, sometimes there's going to be some, you know, kind of rookie growing pains and things like that. And, you know, if you believe, you know, that you drafted successfully, if Mikey Wyshar was the guy for you, then, you know, I think maybe you have to keep giving him the ball a couple more times and, you know, rise or fall, these guys kind of have to be the ones you do it with.
Right. That's what it is. Like, they need midfield production. They're counting on it. And that's why they took Mikey Wyshar number two overall. Maybe you stick him at attack, and they tried it a little bit. Talked about it post game. He was asked about that change, and, you know, he mentioned just wanting to get Mikey more touches, more involved in the offense, and you're going to have to see more product. Like Logan Knipp shooting 0-3, they want him to start getting his as a rookie. They're excited about Matt Campbell. Obviously, they need him to step up earlier in games, and the 2-for-7 is not going to cut it when everyone else is not giving their full best performance as well. So midfield production is going to be key for this group. And I think scoring 5 of the last 7 goals kind of reinforces your point of Brian Holman not being stubborn, but I think wanting to say, hey, like, we were unlucky in the first half, hit some pipes, got away from us. Sometimes these games happen, and let's see if we can put together a good game from there, because now they're coming up against the New York squad, who's also 1-3, and it's just like we said last week, like, we're watching again to see who comes out and loses and who comes out as the 1-4 team from this game. And we asked that very question to a distinguished guest on the PLO Happy Hour podcast. Let's welcome on Hugh Kelleher to the show. We now welcome on to the podcast the man, the myth, the legend, returning guest, even Hugh Kelleher. Hugh, welcome back to the PLO Happy Hour podcast.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me.
Absolutely. We had some recording goal just now, so the juice is already flowing. Rosie reminded me that you were indeed a part of our Championship Media Day podcast extravaganza, so welcome back to the show. And you, it's been quite a year for you. A lot of winning, a lot of titles, a lot of silverware. How does it feel to complete the huge trick, the hat trick of titles, with winning the Cornell National Championship in 2025, the Atlas title last year, obviously most pertinent to this podcast, and then coming away with the 2026 Toronto Rock Championship over Rosie's Halifax Thunderbirds. He's a Thunderbird stan, so one, are you going to apologize to him? And two, how does it feel to just win everything?
Well, first off, I'm sorry, Rosie. I didn't know about your Halifax fandomship, but yeah, obviously, absolutely unreal. Nothing. I would say it's a dream come true, but I don't know if I really dreamed. I dreamed about winning a Cornell National Championship first and foremost. Like, obviously, my 5 years there, it's the goal we set out every single year. And to be able to get it done my senior year was a dream come true. And having the opportunity to even play professional lacrosse in one league and then two leagues is a dream of mine. And then winning a championship my first year in both of them, really, it's unbelievable, to say the least. Got lucky, joined two really great groups, two great groups of guys, unreal locker rooms. Unreal.
At what point did it kind of cross your mind that, you know, there was a possibility, you know, where you're kind of like, hey, wait a second, I might win three of these real quick here.
Yeah, after the Atlas Championship, and then I was starting to think about playing box lacrosse, and CJ kind of had an idea that we had kind of had a feeling CJ was going to be the number one pick and go to the Toronto Rock. If not, he was going to be one of the first three and probably go to the Rock. And then I started thinking about maybe I'll join him. We're roommates in New York City. We could do the travel together. When I officially got drafted by the Rock, I had a couple texts being like, oh, maybe you'll go three for three. I know one of them. I used to work in the equipment cage at Cornell, and my boss, Nick Bruner, he's the man down there. He might have been the first one to text me about it.
What has been your favorite moniker, nickname for Hutrick? Just rolls off the tongue so well. I've seen a few others. Have you landed on a good name for the year that you've had?
Hutrick was good. I'll say that. I think Cornell lacrosse might have came up with that one, so we'll stick with that one for now. But yeah, I think that's the only one.
The fact that you're roommates with CJ makes it that much more gold. Just playing with two of the best players to play the sport, and CJ at Cornell and with the Rock, and Jeff Teat with the Atlas. Of course, we're very sorry that he can't play this season with that shoulder surgery, but just from dating back to the last year, right, with the title run, what's it been like? Just the transition from, all right, I'm playing with a historic Tourton winning season, going into one of the best players of our generation in Teat, also you're Big Red alum, and then you're going right back to CJ Kirst indoor. So nice little year for you.
Yeah, I mean, really, really got lucky playing with those two guys, and obviously really special that they're both Cornell alums, Cornell guys. Really just testaments to like the groups that I've joined. Obviously, starting with Cornell, Unreal Culture, and like some of my best friends, all my best friends for life from that locker room, and then going right in with the Atlas, like not really knowing what to expect with professional lacrosse, and having Gavin Adler and Jeff Teat from Cornell in there, and then kind of dove headfirst into that locker room, and with a bunch of great guys. And then with The Rock, going up with CJ, who was my roommate my freshman year and I've lived with ever since. Just going into a locker room full of Canadians and realizing that they were all really good guys as well. So got really lucky to play with three great groups and even luckier to win a championship with all of them.
And you mentioned, you know, when you heard about, hey, you know, maybe I'll sign in and try to do this NLL thing too. Is that when it first crossed your mind to try playing, you know, pro box, or had that been something you would, you know, maybe had the back of your head for a while?
I had it in the back of my head for a while. After my freshman, technically my freshman year playing in 2022, I went up to Oakville, live with my roommate, Jack Follows. He plays for Calgary now, and we played for the Oakville Buzz together in Junior A. So I got a good taste of box lacrosse up there, and then realized that the NLL is something that I could have the opportunity to do post-graduation. And so it was in the back of my head for sure. Coming off two long seasons, I wasn't too sure like how my body would hold up, but really glad that I decided to play for the Toronto Rock.
How is your body holding up? Because you really have not had much rest dating back to you with these long playoff runs. You're just playing nonstop.
Yeah, it's definitely tough. Coming off the Cornell season and going straight into the PLL was tough. I was dealing with some like lingering injuries, but had a solid month and a half, maybe 2 months off after after the PLL. So I was able to heal up and get a little bit better before box lacrosse. And then as the season went on through with the Toronto Rock, I was able to find my groove of like taking care of my body and then playing games on the weekend. So feeling all healthy now. Everything's good. No complaints.
There you go. Rose, before we ask another, I want to stick to the roommate angle because I think it is really fascinating. Like we heard a few weeks back, Whips were playing Atlas, and Pete LaSala and Xander Dixon are a couple New York City roommates as well, from their Virginia days coming up there, and then Petey scoring on Xander's team in the pro ranks is super cool. Tell us a little bit about you and CJ's relationship and, you know, building off that. We were talking, I think, before we hit record, right? Just of him getting you into the box scene with Toronto and you having an inkling that he might be taken first overall. Take us through kind of the road trips. How cool is it just to bond over all this good stuff? And then the vice versa, coming back from PLL weekends, how kind of interesting that is just to be coming back from two different locker rooms, be like,
yeah.
Nice weekend, right? Like, Kirsch had like a sock trick, obviously not the game that you guys wanted, but tell us a little bit about your guys' roommate.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're best friends, but it's definitely a fun relationship with the NLL this year. It was really nice to have CJ just with all the travel, a lot of Ubers to the airport, a lot of flights up to Toronto, and then staying in hotels together. It was really good to have him around. I think at one point we were talking about it. It was from like New Year's to the week before Memorial Day when the season ended. We traveled every single weekend. I think it was 22 weekends in a row. So now that the PLL is around, it's probably good that we're not with each other as much. Probably needed a little bit of a break. But yeah, it's a cool relationship. I was really happy to be able to play with CJ again for The Rock. Just being teammates at Cornell, winning a championship together, and having the opportunity to do that again was really cool and something we'll never forget. And then also on the competitive side, like whenever the Atlas and the Water Dogs play, it's going to be a heated rivalry in the apartment in New York City that week. And maybe a couple side bets on who wins, maybe take each other out to dinner. And I actually had a bet with CJ going that I was going to hit a two-pointer before he did. And I did last week.
Oh. So
I think he's got to take me out to dinner this week.
Let's go. So we're expensive.
Yeah, so we're good. Definitely got a steak.
You guys are like trying to keep each other up all night to make sure one of you doesn't get enough sleep and that kind of stuff.
I haven't done that yet, but that's a good idea.
good call. Betting on yourself to hit that 2-pointer. Did you think about that after you hit it? Were you kind of like, hey, all right?
Actually, not right after, but after the game, I was texting him, and then I realized, I was like, actually, I thought we had a bet going for that 2-pointer. And then he's like, we definitely did. You got me.
It'd be funny if you were mic'd up and you were just yelling, CJ's getting me a steak. Let's go.
That would have been awesome.
But, yeah, like you coming into this season, right, we're coming away from another weekend of PLL action in Charlotte, going into the league-wide bye. You're kind of the perfect guest for this week in terms of all the winning that you've been doing this year, but also Long Island coming up, you being a Long Island native. How exciting is that to get back home and play in front of some friends and family and hopefully get back on the winning side?
Yeah, it's super exciting, especially after a long season with the Toronto Rock too. Like, not family, friends, like all my aunts, uncles, cousins, they didn't really make it up to too many games to Toronto. So having the opportunity to play at Hofstra in my backyard, it's great. Just, we'll have an unreal environment. I think the Long Island fans will show out pretty well. It should be a great time. Be a good time to see family post game, hopefully after a couple of wins on Long Island. And yeah, just the opportunity to play at Hofstra. A lot of never got to play lacrosse at Hofstra. MacArthur lacrosse didn't make it that far, but had the opportunity to play football there in high school. And then just a lot of memories from high school and then at Cornell, and excited to get back out there.
Hugh, let me ask you a question about Long Island as somebody who's never been there. So basically, I feel like every time we're watching a lacrosse game and the broadcasters start talking about Long Island, or it's like a blowout and they got to fill the space, they start talking about delis, right? And they're always like, don't go to this deli, go to that deli. You know, you got to be a freaking moron to try that one. Go to this one. Is it like just a matter of local pride, or is there really that huge a difference between the delis, like where I get my pastrami sandwich from? Does it actually taste that different?
Now, that's a great question. I would say this is kind of similar with like pizzerias too on Long Island. It's like, I'd say Long Island is pretty consistently great across the board with like pizza and delis. There's definitely some like top tier spots and definitely some like local favorites. Like if you're from this town, you go to this place. But I'd say like if you're walking into a deli on Long Island, you're going to be all right. Yeah. I don't think there's too much disparity. I think that's might be a little crazy, but there's definitely some spots that are top tier.
Bagel sandwich or chicken cutlet? What do you prefer?
I'm a bacon, egg, and cheese guy. I'll go. My order is usually like bacon, egg, and cheese with a hash brown hot sauce.
Yeah, that's my go-to. I covered the game. You guys played Richmond at Hofstra. That was a classic. I did not witness any of your football games in the high school days there, but I'm sure those were some fun times as well. Did you go on any Lizards games perhaps growing up?
Yeah, did. Yeah, I remember watching Rob Pinnell, Paul Rabel, and the Lizards when they came to town. I probably went to like 10 to 15 of those games growing up, and those were always awesome. Great atmosphere. Wow. Being on the other side of it now when you were a little kid, like I remember standing like right outside the bricks behind the end zone and at Hofstra, like waiting for the players to come off. So it's pretty unreal to be on the other side of it now.
Do you have any cool memorabilia memories from those games?
You know what? I did get, I had my Long Island, I had the ticket to the game, and I saw Jim Brown at the game, and I got his autograph.
Wow. And
I need to locate the ticket, but I believe it's somewhere at my house. Maybe I'll go back next week, and I'll try to find it. But yeah, it took a lot of pride in that one. That one was a cool one.
Yeah, you need to get that hung up in your New York City apartment.
I know, I should. Yeah.
Get
It's
CJ
like I
on
just,
it.
yeah, well, he can't find any.
So how does it feel now where, you know, you're about to have this homecoming weekend and, you know, you grew up basically watching it and now kind of the roles are reversed. There's going to be little kids with tickets saying, you know, hey, I got a Hugh Kelleher autograph. I'm going to go hang up on my wall. Like, how does that feel to know that it's all kind of coming around full circle for you?
It's amazing. It's pretty unbelievable to like be on the other side of it and have little kids coming up to me. Meanwhile, it's like, it's not too long ago that I was in the same position. So, yeah, I think it's just like a testament of like, really like any of those little kids at the lacrosse games can be in the position that I'm in and, just keep hitting the wall.
Well, I don't think every little kid in those stands will grow up to be
maybe not everyone,
3 but... 220.
Yeah, that's fair. PLL comes in all shapes and sizes, though, so.
It's true. It's true. That's why it is a beautiful sport. Anyone can make a difference out there. We've seen our Joey Sankey, Billy Bitters of the world. Did you have a crazy growth spurt or anything like that? Or you mentioned both brothers played football in college too. You got the good Kelleher family genes over there.
Yeah, we got the good Kelleher genes from mom and dad, but. Yeah, my dad actually used to own a gym on Long Island, and we'd all work out there. And then, so I was getting dragged there when I was younger. So I was in like,
oh, there it is,
fifth, sixth, seventh grade. Like, I'm like, Dad, I don't want to go. And then he's like, you're coming. Like, my older brothers are working out, and I'm just kind of tagging along. And then I slowly started joining the group. So I was introduced to it at a young age, and kind of stuck with me.
Yeah, here are the secrets come out. When you're going to the family-owned gym at 8 years old, benching and everything, that's going to help for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
So were you like, you mentioned having the older brothers who played football and stuff, were you kind of the runt of the group, got pushed around a little bit by the bigger kids, or how was the situation there?
Definitely growing up, for sure. Playing sports, like they were never letting me win. So yeah, I was always it's like whether it be basketball in the driveway or having football catch across the street, and I was losing.
Now, yeah. Do you think that makes you better? Because I always hear that, like especially like the third one. You know, you have the two who can kind of gang up on the third one and make him, you know, go run their errands for him or whatever. Do you think that's kind of helped you at this point? Maybe pushed you a little further growing up.
Yeah, definitely. Them like bringing out the true competitor in me from a young age, and then and honestly, watching them go through high school sports and college sports was tremendous for me. I'm just seeing like the work that they had to put in to achieve their goals, and then like it's already kind of like a stepping stone for me. It's like I know the things I need to do, so now it's time to do it, and they really paved the path for me to succeed as well.
You had some absolute losses on your championship winning team in Cornell in 2025, including Walker Wallace, a great personality. I loved watching some of the behind the scene looks that we got during that season, whether it was from Pelkey in the off season or what have you, but you know, he got to scratch that itch, play a little football post grad at Virginia. Did you have an itch that you wanted to scratch as well after your lacrosse career? Or
I entered the portal to play football like in like the winter of my senior year. And then, like as the season went on, like, I got interest, but I was getting very banged up from lacrosse. I had a couple of injuries that were nagging, so I was started to think about it. And was like, I have the opportunity to play professional lacrosse, which was like a dream of mine growing up. I remember when my dad sent me something the other day, said like I think I was in like third grade, and I was like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I was like, oh, I want to be a pro lacrosse player. So being able to fulfill that dream was one of the deciding factors for me. And then like also my body is like, I don't know if I would have survived like a full summer camp of football with like existing injuries on top of it already going into 2 days. So I decided to play professional lacrosse. Coach Pressler reached out to me. He asked me if I was playing football, and then talked with Gavin Adler about it, and then I decided not to. And then Pressler was able to grab me in the fourth round.
Value pick indeed, and you just keep on winning. Like, the you know, oh, like football is too much contact, and then going to the Toronto Rock season after your Atlas year, playing defense. I guess you're the one finally providing the punishment after years of LSMs just whack you and guys slide into your downhill dodging. Was that a nice little transition for you to start cross-checking everyone else for once?
Yeah, it was. Especially after seeing like CJ with all his bumps and bruises, like, oh, I'm on the D end. Like, I could just, I'm just giving it out. And it's like, oh, you're sore after the game? Like, I'm not too bad. It's like the offensive guys in the NHL just take a beating. And it's like just them trying to get through the defense, like setting picks for their teammates. Like, we have the ability to just start whacking them, moving them around, and takes a toll. So, yeah, I was happy to learn the defense. I had a great defensive coach in Bruce Codd that me and CJ loved. And then the defensive guys on the team, the vets, they were unreal. They were all great guys, showed me the ropes, and I was able to get the hang of it.
So speaking of the Rock, after you guys win the championship and you get the cup, What's the procedure like there? Do you guys like Stanley Cup wise? Does everybody get a day with it? How do you guys break that down?
Yeah, so is Stanley Cup like everyone gets a day with it? Is that what they do?
Yeah,
so that's what we've been doing. It's being passed around. It's strictly only in Canada right now. So me and CJ got to get our hands on it soon. I think we will. I think we'll get the shipment down once maybe all the guys are done with it and have it in New York City for a week.
What's the plan with it? What are you going to do with your time with the cup?
I don't know. It's not leaving that apartment once you guys get it.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. Once we nail down a date, I think maybe we'll get some family and friends together and go to a nice restaurant or something with the cup. Go out and celebrate.
Good call.
Rosie was looking this up. Is there a Toronto Rock parade coming up, maybe?
Yeah. I think it's it might be tomorrow. They have, like, the Rock City Unplugged, which is, like, the YouTube series for the team. And then I think, like, the final episode's airing at the stadium. So, like, all the fans are going to go to the stadium and, like, the players, and then I think they're going to have like a little parade for that as well down in Hamilton, up in Hamilton.
Are you planning on headed up there?
No, I got to go to work, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, yeah. The old grindstone. But I'm sure you'll relish the celebrations from afar. Can you contrast for us a little bit the week/couple days, maybe hours even after winning a title for Cornell, for Atlas, and for the Rock? What was that like for you? And rank the celebrations for us, because we don't want to hear any cop-out answers either.
All right. I'm going to go Cornell 1. Cornell 1's the easy one for me. I mean, like, 4 years of playing and that being your goal, and then winning it with your best friends, and winning it for Cornell and all the people there. That was a dream come true. And celebrating with the team on the field, have everyone's families there, and then back in the locker room, and then at the tailgate, and then on the bus on the way back to Ithaca, and then in Ithaca, and then in Ithaca again. that 48 hours was unreal. And and then I had to go to training camp for the Atlas pretty quickly after that, so I didn't really get to enjoy the full celebration, but definitely those 48 hours for good. Now I don't know if they were good enough, but I wish I got a couple more days.
A good 48 hours for a 48-year title drought ended. Yeah. So there you go.
True. There we go. And then I think I'll go Toronto Rock to I'll go Toronto Rock to be in Halifax. Was really cool. Getting to go out in Halifax that night was awesome. The locker room celebration was awesome with the champagne and everything. Just seeing how much it meant to all those guys in the locker room, and they've been playing forever. And then they were giving me and CJ some shit because he's like, I've been playing 18 seasons and you guys show up and win your first year. Like, that's messed up. yeah, it was a good time in Halifax. And then me and CJ had a 10 a.m. flight out of Halifax, and then we boarded it. They kicked us off the flight, and then it got canceled. And then we went back to the celebration with all the guys there at like a restaurant on the water, and then we went right back to it.
It's meant to be.
Yeah, it was meant to be. But yeah, we weren't supposed to be on that flight back to New York City that soon, so they let us know to get back there with the boys.
Yeah, it's cool.
The Atlas Championship was also great. It's like we had a great time in New Jersey where we won in the locker room after winning it with Jeff and Gavin was awesome. Then we headed into New York City. Winning it on a Sunday is always tough because everyone's gotta get out of there. So, and reality sets in, you gotta go to work. So that was the shortest celebration. So we'll rank that one third, but. I mean, all of them were unreal and great memories.
It's a good reason why. And the atmosphere there, though, at Sports Illustrated Stadium was pretty unreal. Thinking back to Rosie and I were off in the press box together, and we were pretty high up there, and we had a good vantage point of just the crowd erupting and just it's such a thrilling game in total. So, game-wise, that was definitely up there for just overall entertaining purposes.
Yeah, that game was back and forth to the wire, and then the atmosphere there was awesome. Yeah, there was a ton of people at Sports Illustrated, and then it was a great memory.
So speaking of championships, see if you can clear something else up for me here. So situation like this year, NCAAs, right? When you have Princeton and Notre Dame, as a Cornell guy, are you like go Ivy League, or at that point, if it's not Cornell, do you not want Ivy League people getting the title if it's not you guys?
Yeah, that was a tough one that the guys were talking about in the group chat. Like, who do we root for here?
Yeah.
But I think going into that game, like Princeton beat Cornell, and then it's like they, I think if everyone had really had a feeling. I remember going into the game, like me and my roommates, Ryan Sheehan and CJ, really, I think Princeton's going to pull this out by like 4 or 5. We had a good feeling about Princeton. Like they're pretty unstoppable this year. They had a great squad, great offense, great all around. So might as well. We'll root Ivy for that one.
The fraud watch is over.
Yeah, the fraud watch is over.
Is CJ there in the apartment?
No, because he had USA tryouts.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. There's a pretty grueling back to back for not just the Carolina Chaos, but all the guys going straight to Team USA training camp prep for Japan 2027 for the World Cross Championship. Yeah, the fact that you are a ginger, CJ is also a red-haired stud, couple ginger beauties. Do you take some pride in the fact that your mascot's the Big Red and you guys are kind of the two of the leading forces on that team being redheads?
Yeah, definitely take pride in the big red and having red hair. You got to embrace it. But when I was younger, playing True Blue, my coach Tom Engelke, he's a legend of the sport. He used to call me Big Red, so it was kind of like a full circle moment when I got recruited to Cornell. He's like, "Big Red's going to the Big Red."
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
That's so funny. I also want to shout out Hugh, just, you know, doing our little due diligence, our research here on your team page, looking at the recipient of the inaugural Tom Flatley Award back in your high school days. So a athlete and a scholar and a gentleman off the field. Tell us a little bit about your off-field accomplishments. Talk yourself up a little bit with how you were in the thick of it with this book collection of packing backpack. I don't know why I'm laughing, because this is a very noble, full supplies for underprivileged students of or lacrosse clinic for kids with autism. Tell us a little bit about your high school days. Are you still doing any cool off the field stuff like that up there in the city?
Yeah, we actually just went to a city life event in New York City the other day. So definitely want to get more involved with the city lacs. And then, yeah, so throwing it back to the PAL, helping out with them. Those were awesome. I remember being in like middle school and high school going to, it was actually like Memorial High School. It's like a high school that Levittown used to have like so many people in it, but now it's like not as many kids in there. So there's three high schools and now there's only two. So that one's just like still there, like for like some programs in high school and stuff like that. So we go there, help out with the lacrosse program for kids with autism and kids with Down syndrome, and help them out. And I love doing that, just playing lacrosse with them and helping out and teaching them the game. So that was always a good time.
We'll end it with a couple spin forward Atlas questions for you. You got a doubleheader coming up. You've lost a couple here. You know, coming after a title winning season, you losing your star player and Jeff Teat. How do you guys get things working again offensively? You play the Boston Cannons, who are going to be hungry. They've got a defense that's kind of reeling, and they're looking for answers, and they're hoping to find some momentum against you guys. The loser of that game goes to 1-4, so it's a big game for both of you. And then you're it's not a very nice second game, because you're playing the league leader in Maryland at 3-1. So, well, what's going to be the key up there in Long Island to getting some wins?
Yeah, I think the key is this week we have film, and we'll get better on our own this week. And then I think emphasizing the little things for us offensively, just being able to move the ball, share the ball, taking like great shots over good shots, things we all know what to do. We're all professionals, just kind of putting it together. And we felt better about our performance last week against the Red Wiz. It felt like we moved the ball a lot. We took, I think, like 50 or 51 shots in that game. Just credit to Dylan Ward. He played phenomenal. So we feel good about our offense. We'll get Cospiel and Trainer back this week, which would be huge for us. And then, yeah, taking it one game at a time, first against the Cannons. They're good squad, and then the Whips. So, especially in the PLL, I think everybody knows anyone could beat anyone. We're 1-3, so it'll be a good opportunity for us to get back to 500 on the line.
And you just mentioned, you know, getting a bunch of your shots up there. Career high for you in shots in this past game and in points. Was there a kind of more of an emphasis or maybe a discussion that, you know, the team was going to need you to kind of escalate your offensive role, especially with Costabile and Trainer out? And how did you see that kind of playing forward going the rest of the season?
Yeah, it was kind of just a next man up mentality with Costabile and Trainer out. Obviously, both two great initiators that we have. But I'm hoping that I can continue playing well and be a great addition in the midfield and provide more, even more production, and along with those guys, because I feel like we'll be pretty dangerous if everyone's clicking on all cylinders.
And since we're just talking about offense, you know, had some changes there, you know, Birksy leaves the team. Now you guys have Scott Jurek in place. What's it kind of been like getting to know him as your new offensive coordinator?
Yeah, Scott's awesome. Yeah, he's been doing a great job with us. He's still like learning about our group, but he's letting us play to our strength. He's doing a good job letting us play free and playing to our strength. So it really suits our offense to be successful and play off of each other. We have a lot of great players on our team. So emphasizing the need to make the right decisions, make the simple plays when they're there. And then, so when a player like Connor Schellenberger has an open shot on the outside because we drew a couple slides, like we'll take it, and it's a great look for us.
Your left side has been fascinating, not just because Jeff Teat is not there this season, but because Levi Anderson, who had that swimming score in overtime against you back in the day and that crazy semifinal game, going back away, and then what was it like interacting and playing with Matt Rambo this past weekend?
Yeah, playing with Matt Rambo was awesome. It was great to meet him. I've never really met him before, but he's a great guy. I mean, he honestly brings a good presence of like veteran leadership that we need offensively. So yeah, it was great to have him. We were bouncing ideas off of each other. He was giving us a lot of great insight into it's like obviously it's a disappointing start to the season for us, but just like that we've been in this position before. Even last year we started 1-2 and then won a championship, and then he was talking about his time with the Whips and how they basically did the same thing. So it's not really about how you start in this league. It's about getting better every week and hot at the right time towards the end of the season, and then making a push for a championship. So we're excited to get better over the next couple of weeks, and got a couple wins in Hofstra.
It's a good note to leave it. Unless Rosie, you have another. I should stop harping on this, but it is fast. Like you mentioned, the team zooms and stuff. First off, you have any practice plans or anything on the off week?
No. So yeah, we'll be off, which
is league-wide bye. I think everyone is off. But with the team zooms and stuff, it's just is there any extra concerted effort? You got the headphones in, you're away from CJ, no shared team plans being in the common room, the apartment.
Yeah, no way. Like I'm locked in my room. Turn the AC on so you can't really hear, headphones in. Yeah, we're not playing around with that stuff.
good. Love it. Hugh, you're a beauty. Thanks for joining the show, and again, good luck and enjoy your homecoming back there in Hofstra.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you guys. Thanks, Rosie. Thanks, Kevin. Yeah.
Thanks.
What a great interview that was, Rosie. Wow. Just a very personable guy for being 6'3" and awesome and at sports, just a great guy to talk to. And any takeaways from that interview, Rosie?
I mean, if all I did was win championships, I would also be a great guy to talk to, right? I'd be the friendliest guy around. I have no beefs with anybody. The man is just on a run, a historic run of just showing up everywhere. And you know, he was very humble about it, saying, you know, he had the fortune of being on these good teams and stuff. But, like, you know, part of the reason the teams are so good are because you're on them, Hugh. Mm-hmm. You know, so pat yourself on the back a little bit there. But, he's fantastic. Repeat guest of the program. We're big Hugh Kelleher fans around these parts.
An important role.
Even though he beat the Halifax Thunderbirds.
He did apologize, though. I was surprised to see hear such an immediate apology. I was like, listen, man, you do not have to apologize for winning. An important role on all three of those title winning seasons for those three teams. And for his Atlas, you know, when you win three straight championships as Hugh Kelleher, sometimes you need the come back down to earth and get humbled. They've lost three straight, and they're They have a great opportunity ahead of them, just like he framed it. Nice little positive mindset from Hugh. And they have an opportunity to win both games and get back to 500. I mean, right back in the hunt. If you do that and see if reigning MVP Connor Schellenberger can up his impact on this offense to rise all boats in that tide and see if they can make things happen. Those are huge games to watch up there on Long Island after this league-wide bye. Rosie, I want to get back to some standings talk here. You know, Chaos have played 5 games at 3-2. The Redwoods have only played 3 at 2-1. We talked about Boston being in trouble. Who can they, like, trade for? You look at all the Philly playmakers, even. A lot we can discuss. I want to start with, though, with Denver Outlaws. They came up on the wrong side of the score line in the third straight surprising result of week 4 when they ran into a red hot Blaze. And Chad Palumbo is just having a month, man. He's having a month. He's having a year. He's having a freaking year. Continued it at training camp for Team USA. He scored another couple goals late. The decisive one to the eventual game winner in the 12-11 win against Denver. But from the Outlaws' perspective, my take on it is you do not want to be in that first round matchup. Again, it is the same playoff format as last year in that the second versus third seeds in each conference will play each other in the conference semifinals in the first round, aka not really quarterfinals because they're just not 8 teams, as the bottom two, the bottom finisher in each respective conference will not make the postseason. So if you're one of those, the 2 or 3 seed, like, good chance you're playing Blaze if the Carolina Chaos don't get the top seed out west. And you don't want that, because we've seen what the Chaos defense can do in the first round of the playoffs over the years. So my take on it is that they, from here, and we saw Brennan O'Neill kind of spin it positively, like learning from losses is a good thing, right? We have work we can do here. But they need to take it seriously. Like, they need to make sure that they are giving everything they have to lock up a top seed out west to get a bye into that next round. And these early games matter. They add up. And when you're only a goal away, you trade everything for Evan Plunkett. You think you're just a piece away offensively. You welcome Pat Kavanaugh back on the offense. He only gets a couple fast break goals. Like, you need to make sure it's not panic time for any stretch of the imagination, but you certainly need to take these games seriously, and it was certainly a needed bounce back from Carolina's perspective, though.
Yeah, absolutely, to both points. Yeah, certainly not panic time, you know, but there is just no margin for error right now in that Western Conference. You know, you can't really look at anybody and just think, you know, that team is, you know, it's kind of a wash for them this year. You know, even if you felt that way before this past weekend about Utah because of their offensive struggles, you know, they showed us a little something that we'll get to later. So, yeah, I mean, you got to get these wins, especially, you know, like a close one like this. You know, we're talking about, you know, looking back in hindsight with a score differential sort of situation, you know, one goal difference in something like this, it's going to see, you know, maybe a couple weeks down the road, this might be something they look back on and think, you know, maybe we didn't quite, you know, shift it into overdrive in time or something like that. So, yeah, I do certainly agree that you can learn a whole lot of lessons from losses, but also, you know, they are just losses as well. So don't go don't go learning too many lessons there, Brendan O'Neill, or it's going to be it's going to be time for next season. But yeah, you know, I think any sort of momentum or energy wise like this, huge, huge win for Carolina. You know, they were definitely kind of down after that first one. You could tell losing that first night of their homecoming. I feel like especially, you know, you get back home after they had this big win against Philly the weekend prior and everything's feeling great. You know, they're talking about their lineup becoming whole. You know, you got all your guys back. You get Owen Hills back. You get Palumbo delivering. Everybody's kind of clicking, feeling good. Then they go out and score 7 and kind of get lit up by that Archers offense. You know, you say, wait a second, what's going on? Maybe we don't have this all figured out. Stephen Brooks seemed real bummed in the press conference afterwards, cause, you know, especially you want to perform, you know, for your home fans and everything. And, you know, you get doubled up on that first night, and it's a tough go. But I think being able to kind of put things together, secure the conference win, and, you know, to do it with a, you know, a tough sort of one goal game where, you know, everybody's kind of scrapping for that one extra advantage here or there, getting another kind of late performance from your rookie, whole lot to feel great on, you know, having this downtime now, and then they've got this bye coming up. I think we kind of mentioned it on the last podcast, you know, if they were in a situation where had they gone 0-2, then they got a bunch of weeks to just kind of sit and stew in that 0-2, you know, funk, dropping the games in their homecoming. So, yeah, this was, you know, if there's such thing as a must win right now, you know, this might have been their must win, really kind of turn things around on a positive note.
Mentioned Denver there, or you mentioned Utah, excuse me, doubling up Carolina in the first surprise of the weekend, 15-7 winners as their offense finally found its rhythm. Rosie, what were some of your takeaways from Mac O'Keefe scoring 7, Trey Leclerc getting downhill and scoring? What impressions did you take away from the offense finally finding their groove?
So, you know, glass half full, glass half empty, right? Half full, 15 goals, just tremendous. Especially, I saw Trey Leclerc hand out assists, which is not usually something he does. So if it's something where he's kind of adapting his game because that's the role that they might need him to fit, then that's amazing if they can get that sort of production out. I think what you're going to see from Utah is it's just kind of a matter of consistency, right? Because, like, Mac O'Keefe had those 7 goals, phenomenal. He said, you know, he kind of knew he was feeling good after the first one went. it was very funny him trying to explain it to, you know, a room full of mortals, right? Like, what it feels like to score 7 goals in the PLL. We were like, yeah, but when did you know you were hot? He was like, right away. And you're like, yeah, but like, how's it feel? And he's like, no, I knew this is what I is. You can't. He you know, he did not do a great job because it is impossible to tell somebody how it feels to know you're going to drop 7 goals in a PLL game. But so yeah, phenomenal job by Mac O'Keefe dropping the 7. Glass half empty. He had scored 7 goals in his past 8 games combined leading up to it. So if the Archers can get a little bit of consistency, you know, obviously you don't need 7 from Mac every time. You can get 2 from him, right? But you can just get it every time. And then, you know, get a few people chipping in here and there. You know, I think they'll be in much better shape. I think Dobson in goal with that defense. I mean, look, Dobson plus Tony Resch, let alone all the rest of the guys they've got, but those two
equals
alone
ice cream
equals ice cream, right? You're getting some ice cream. So, you know, they just need the offensive consistency. And, you know, that's what I think we'll see in the upcoming weeks. It's going to be the real difference maker. Can they do this or something close consistently? Cause if the defense can hold you to, you know, 8 goals, you know, you should win. They just got to have consistent contributions.
The defense is certainly always consistent, always showing up for them. Opponents scoring less than 8 goals per game so far through week 4. Rosie, we've probably talked about the Redwoods the least on this podcast this season. They've played the least is the reason. They're three games into the year. They just welcomed back their rookie of the year, Chris Kavanaugh. Mikey Boehm, another four-point performance, one goal, three assists. Ryder Garnsey coming out of the box. What were your impressions of them being able to take down the defending champs over the weekend?
The thing I think about the Redwoods is the way they've got their offense set up right now. If you've joined the team like Ryder Garnsey did, or even, I guess, to a much, much lesser degree, the way Chris Kavanaugh did, you kind of have to hop in with what they're doing, you know? And I think that's especially something that Ryder Garnsey experienced. You know, this is the kind of the added sort of element of difficulty when you have the season that's a little slid up, and, you know, you've got the guys coming in at different times. You know, maybe you had a starting role on the attack, but you're a college coach. And if they don't necessarily, you know, if they had somebody who's contributing in your spot, maybe your spot isn't yours anymore, right? So you kind of have to, as the kind of the challenges of player, you know, in like Garnsey's cases, you have to kind of figure out a way to, you know, contribute to this lineup in a way that you didn't do previously. And ultimately, it might make the team better, right? You know, if you can get, you know, say 20 touches from Ryder Garnsey coming out of the box and, you know, doing what he can do, I guess maybe on a more reduced level than what we'd seen previously. But if he can still get, like, if he can get you, like, 1-1 and the rest of the team keeps going offensively business as usual like they were, you know, in the prior weeks to his arrival, then I think everybody wins. You know, his numbers may suffer a little bit, but I think the team will be better off for it.
Over in the Eastern Conference, Rosie, the playoff race is already heating up. No need to harp on this too much because we're not even at the halfway point yet. And it's just interesting to look big picture at it all, right? And keep it all in mind. Like we were talking about the playoff format. The Cannons and Atlas, of course, have that big game coming up that we previewed. And then you have the Water Dogs and Whipsnakes, the two dubs of the league that are looking really good. Great offensive ball movement. Had Boston reeling back-to-back games. So you look like Denver is still the favorite in the sports books because I think the West is clearly easier to get out of. And then the East, it's going to be crazy. I think the Whipsnakes and Water Dogs are at this stage, the clear favorites to advance into that Eastern Conference semifinal or Eastern Conference final, it would be. Any thoughts on kind of how things are shaping up in terms of Boston prospects of bouncing back, Atlas finding a groove at home to get back to 500? Who has a chance to get out of the East and give Philly and Maryland a run for their money?
So, I mean, I genuinely have no idea. And I do love that they face off next, Boston and New York, because I think they could both tell you, look, we've got some issues we're working through on our offense. You know, we think we've got some pieces in place. We think we're kind of, you know, riding the ship. But yeah, you know, we're working things out as we go. And it is like, you know, well, you better figure it out, like, quickly, because they're both right there, you know, like Boston and New York, especially in the New York having their homecoming game against Boston, right? Like that could be just that's a game I definitely have circled because we can see who has kind of taken these 2 weeks that it's going to be to kind of figure out what they're going to roll out that is going to be good enough and bounce back off of losses a very different fashion. But both coming off of these losses and some downtime to try to figure things out. I'm terrible for predictions, especially in PLL wins versus losses, because you know what I mean. Like you generally,
especially when it's June still. Like
yeah. Like you know,
Interesting question could be like Philly versus Maryland, right? Like who? Like Maryland is so interesting to me that they look a little over reliant maybe, and this is obviously 3-1 start. Like I'm thinking about that really impressive Joey Spallina debut where the ball was really moving and when defenses start to make them Dodgers and can really force them to score unassisted goals. Can Aiden Carroll carry them? Can TJ Malone carry them? I think so. But they don't have as many bona fide, let's say, weapons as Philly can roll out there. But again, there's only one ball. So kind of depends on how well you're grooving at that stage of the season. And that's what this is all about, is kind of priming yourself to make sure you're ready to be peaking at that time of the year. So any keys that you'll have your eye on from now to see those two in particular to see how they can kind of improve week by week?
Well, I mean, so just kind of as far as the top two and the bottom two, in that East, it's so fascinating to me the way they split there. Because, you know, if you're talking about Maryland defense, because, you know, as I think I might have said before, Matt Dunn kind of mentioned this during their homecoming weekend. The first game, the Maryland offense won it. And, you know, and that ball movement was ridiculous. They looked just, you know, steps ahead of everybody else we'd seen. And then the second game was against Utah, right? And he said the defense won that one. And so if you take a team that can have a defense and offense that wins the games, I think that's kind of, I feel like that's kind of a sort of a potential championship indicator, right? You got to kind of be able to win clean or dirty, right? Or, you know, have your track meets that you win or your kind of, 5-4 games or something like that. And so then if you look at a team that's capable of both of those things, and they line up against Philly, right? You say, okay, so this Philly offense looked pretty phenomenal. How will they fare against that Maryland defense? You know, especially, I mean, we've seen so many of those matchups, right, where you see Zapatello versus Sowers over the years. And, you know, that sort of matchup, or, you know, you get maybe Dunn and McCardle or something like that. All those rookies playing, like, short stick going against, you know, the Kyle Lewis's, Josh Yagas of the world. Does that work out really well for Maryland? I don't know. You know, Staggs was very impressed by his rookie short sticks. They are going to get a huge test when ultimately they do end up having to cover maybe Silas Richmond.
Almost like stacking your roster in preparation to face all the options Philly can throw at you.
Yeah. They're kind of on a collision course, right, where they're kind of both building – it's like they're planning to face each other. When it happens, I think it's going to be phenomenal, but I have no idea what that result is going to be.
Captain Jake Bernhardt, a casualty as a result, sent to the player pool after a great Whipsnakes career. The Whipsnakes also tweeted out a nice little tribute for Matt Rambo as he was cleaned by the Atlas after three games on the unprotected 25-man. I'll put out a report on this. I reached out to Gavin Adler. He missed his past game for the Philadelphia Water Dogs, injured his thigh early against the Chaos. He felt it right away. He told me that it he feared it was a terror, and it was a terror. That sounds scary, but he's already feeling better. He's in good spirits and does expect to be back by San Diego weekend against the Utah Archers. So overall, good news for Philadelphia fans, as it was important that he took that game off, or else it would have done some more unnecessary damage for the rest of the season. And the defense stepped up, next man mentality without him. So the short sticks I mentioned in praise, but you gotta shed some light on that close unit with Kenny Brower laying lumber with a couple big hits in there, and Matt DeLuca making a franchise record 20 saves. So great weekend to be a Water Dogs fan indeed. With that piece of news added on top of it, with reigning defensive player of the year, Gavin Adler, expected in short order. Rosie, you want to end the podcast on a good note or a bad note?
Yikes. What if we do the bad, like, half as long as we should, but then we'll end it on a good?
Good. That's where my mind was thinking as well. We had it in the wrong order in the rundown. And the sad news, you know, we already lost Jeff T for the season. You were covering the WL game between the Boston Guard and the California Palms. After scoring, what was it, 4 goals, 2 assists, Charlotte North goes down. You heard it immediately. A tough moment to watch. He was mic'd up, which made it so much worse. And honestly, it gave fans, like, you knew at least what was happening, but still heartbreaking nonetheless. And confirmed out for the season, out for the World Lacrosse Women's World Championship with Team USA as well, coming up later this summer. So a huge bummer for women's lacrosse fans and the WLL in their first full inaugural season. Just a bump in the road for Charlotte North, and, you know, she'll have to recover from this. But Rosie, just a few words on just the scene and kind of other star power, other faces having to step up now with Charlotte North out.
Yeah, no, it was a very tough scene. Very close game throughout. Tons of lead changes and ties. And, you know, she was just, as is often the case with something like, you know, you hear from Achilles tears, she was just kind of cutting towards the ball. She was getting covered way off ball by Allie Mastriani. Just, you know, same sort of cut she's done a million times. And, you know, just, yeah, hits the ground. And, yeah, I guess it's weird. Fortunately for, you know, that you kind of are there with her, but also very unfortunately, it's a weird situation to be mic'd up when you get hurt like that. It's a weird and very rare sort of situation. But yeah, no, it was, I don't want to sound too overdramatic, but yeah, it was kind of an emotionally devastating sort of note, because maybe it's a thing kind of... maybe similar to some Achilles tears. I've never done it myself. It's not a matter of, like, you know, you didn't hear screaming or anything. Like, I'll just say that, like, you know, people listening weren't, you know, grossed out hearing, you know, like, arriving in pain. But the tough part is, it's more sadness than anything else, which makes it especially difficult. You know, you felt like at the time, she was kind of processing the stuff that she wouldn't get to do, which is, you know, I guess if you've hurt yourself, sometimes that's the thing that's kind of tough right away. You sort of have your future flash before your eyes sometime, right? You know, you say, I've got this I'm supposed to do next week. I got this supposed to do next month. And you start thinking about all the things that are kind of out the window. So, I mean, obviously I don't have that kind of insight into her brain specifically, but that kind of sounded like, you know, when she was saying, you know, kind of a, you know, in denial, it can't, you know, this can't be happening right now, that sort of thing. But yeah, it's very difficult. And, you know, she seems to be at least in a decent space with it. You know, she posted a picture of her recreating Kobe Bryant's picture when he was being wheeled in to Achilles surgery. So at least she had the game sense to roll out an athletic tribute like that.
Yeah, great.
On field wise, it is obviously, you know, she is one of those people similar to what the Atlas are dealing with. It's like, well, we're not going to go get another Charlotte North, right? We're going to have everybody contribute a whole bunch. And, you know, the Guard are, you know, winless, kind of facing a little bit of an uphill battle to make it into the postseason. And so obviously it got a little more difficult, but, you know, they will keep tinkering. They do have a whole bunch of superstars on that team. Maddie Epke was a rookie addressing her first game, just absolute monster on draw controls. So they have a lot of people who can, you know, contribute in their own ways. Shea Dolce and Baker were fantastic. You know, they got some names. That is the thing about a four-team league, right? Everybody's got a whole bunch of people. Rachel Clark, Kenzie Kent is, you know, a monster as well. So, yeah, you know, I'm sure they would say the same thing, next person up, and they will try to fight back for Charlotte. And, you know, the queen will rise again.
Right, like, they do have other weapons. Kenzie Kent is so electric. Rachel Clark, the next BC great, the breaker single-season scoring record for the Eagles. That is the shame, too. It was such a great game versus the Palms that, you know, that is the headliner and that overshadows it. But just it was a great game, right? Like the back and forth nature of it all. And that when that takes the air out of it, it's kind of advantage California.
Yeah, it's real tough. You know, I want to say there were about maybe 5 minutes left in the game. And so, yeah, it had been tied at that point, but, you know, you're obviously going to be all sorts of rattled if you're the guard and you just saw, you know, not only Charlotte North, but you just saw your captain and, you know, your team leader kind of, you know, just kind of go down like that. You got a lot flying through your heads. So, you know, certainly no disrespect to the Palms because they were tremendous all game, but it's got to be tough to snap into the mindset, you know, with 5 minutes left to try to, you know, stay composed and win that game. But yes, no, it was a fantastic game all in all.
Second straight fantastic game. The Palms getting on the right side of this one after a heartbreaking overtime loss to the Maryland Charm at Loyola, which was just a joy to cover. Rosie, let's end on a more positive note. The PLL announced their 2026 Hall of Fame class with three absolute studs, and a huge shout out to the inaugural contributor in the Hall of Fame, Joe Tsai, for all he's done for the sport. You'll recognize these names if you're a fan of pro lacrosse. Most ever is a theme with these three. Brody Merrill as the most ever games played, 200. In his career, a pretty illustrious one at that. Most ever ground balls, not even a face-off guy, 1,120. And Greg Grenlian, the most ever face-off wins with a whopping 2,263 at the stripe. And, you know, Anthony Kelly, the Redwoods coach, is second all time, and he's 443 behind him. Drew Adams, most all time saves, kind of a career that goes under the radar for some, interestingly enough, maybe because of didn't have quite as much notoriety or success at the international level, is a theory. He had the most ever saves, 1,966. Rosie, fun little question for you. You covered these players in their prime. I want you to pick out a memory, rapid fire, first one that comes to your mind, either of covering them, interacting with them, anything, or just one of their playing accomplishments Let's start with Brody Merrill. We'll go to Greg Grandlin. Then we'll go to Drew Adams. What comes to mind when Brody Merrill, Hall of Famer, covering him back in the day?
Well, so real quick, I'll say Brody Merrill, like you mentioned, the ground balls, 11-20, tied for number one with Greg Grandlin, also going in, also with 11-20. So I'm proposing at the Hall of Fame ceremony, they get him on the line, roll one out, and we'll break this tie once and for all. I think it's the only way to do it. If you're going to let them both in, just, you know, one's got to go. But no, that's a great question. I mean, Brody Merrill, when I think about covering Brody Merrill, I think about how different his position was, or like how different the long stick position was, or just offensive-minded defenseman or anything like that. He just was so incredibly different from everybody who came after him. And it was almost like a sort of a fraternity. You see like Brody Merrill and Kyle Sweeney going through Georgetown. And then, you know, now it's, you know, now we see we saw the Ratliffs, and you see like the Ethan Rawls and you know, CJ Constabile and Tyler Carpenter scored, you know, hundreds of points when he was, you know, in high school and stuff like that. But it was just, you know, if you had a long pole, you generally get the ball and pass it to somebody else. And Brody Merrill was like, well, I'm better at scoring than them too. So I'll just handle it myself. Thank you. So like, it's almost just memory of him is almost just of him floating up and down the field and covering, you know, arc to arc in four steps, right? Because he's just so smooth and just so much faster than everybody else. And in a vacuum that doesn't really make sense. Like, how are you so good at snagging ground balls? Greg Grandlin, what jumps out to me, is the year that he won the MVP. And, you know, we have since seen Trevor Baptiste do it. But before, it was like, no, face-off guy isn't going to win the MVP, right? Like, come on. He, you know, he just shows up and gets the ball to somebody. He gets the ball to a little cross player.
Paul Rabel and Rob Bonnell, like, what are we doing?
Yeah. So you have to be so undeniably dominant to be the one who kind of breaks the common understanding that somebody your position isn't going to do it, right? But he was so dominant with the Lizards, and he's kind of expanding his game and, you know, kind of revolutionizing the position and, you know, becoming more of a threat offensively as well. You couldn't just kind of, you know, you couldn't just go stick to Rabel and Pinnell and, you know, have him kind of run around trying to figure out who to give the ball to, because he could just come down and score as well. And so, yeah, when I think of him, I think of his MVP season just because, you know, you're watching this guy and it's like, you know, he's going, you know, 85%, he's going 90%. You know, it's just what he had done had simply not been done. And Drew Adams was just kind of, you know, same sort of staple in that Lizards core where they were just super successful for a while. And I think one thing I remember about him is just consistency, you know. Not so much flair, would often make kind of ridiculous saves where, you know, it's kind of flopping around or flying, you know, very, very, very capable of, you know, throwing his body in one direction where half of it's already going in the other direction and things like that. And so I just remember his time, you know, as a staple where you don't have to worry about replacing him in goal or anything like that. And he would just come out and have these, you know, 20 odd save games. Just kind of the staple of consistency throughout the MLL. And like you said, just his numbers are so much higher than everyone else's. And that's got to be tough to do, especially, you know, earlier in the MLL sort of period where, you know, so many people are, you know, maybe not sticking around as long. You know, you look at that, the saves list, and there's some guys up there, you know, who maybe played 6 or 7 years, and then they were like, you know, screw this. I don't want to do this anymore. It's tough to, you know, justify being a goalie for this long in this league. And he was just always out there, stable and very sort of laid back in the cage. And, yeah, no, he was a phenom as well. all deserving. I have no beef with any of the people who they voted in. I thought it was all a matter of time for all of them. So, yeah, all well-deserved honors.
Yeah, and you can't really beef with this class. Last season, not to say that class was a down year, but, like, it's nice to go back to just greatness, right? Like, absolute Hall of Fame, indisputable, just elite, all-time greatness. And the resumes just back it up, obviously.
Yeah. This class is, like, statistically undeniable. You know what I mean? Like, previous years, you look at somebody and you say, you know, if you put in, say, like a Josh Sims or, you know, a Brendan Mundorf or something like that, you could put them in and then somebody say, oh, well, why are they in? And then maybe you'd have to explain, you know, or what their contribution was like. Or, you know, if you saw them play, it was like this and that, right? This one, you can just show them a top 10 list and, you know, point to the top of the list and say, there they are. I say, okay, yeah, no arguments here. So yeah, just undeniable. I'm also glad they put someone in who isn't a player. Obviously, Josiah isn't just a nobody. But yeah, I think the avenue should be open for people who aren't just players to be able to, you know, reach the Hall of Fame as well. So hopefully he's the first of many to come.
It's all a matter of time. Until Chris Rosenthal gets that BLO Hall of Fame golden jacket.
That's what I'm saying here. That's what I'm really saying. Say, kudos to Joe Tsai for opening the door for me to reach the Hall of Fame. That's what I was getting at there.
We need to make that happen. But your idea of Greg Renlian and Brody Merrill getting on like a face-off wing and just like, all right, go duel it out. Who's got the record? I love that idea. Any other wrinkles we want to throw at that? Like maybe have a couple people in second place. They're like throwing stuff at them while they're going for it, throwing checks at them.
who would you want to check less? Brody Merrill or Greg Renlian?
I'd want to check. Well, immediately I was going to say Greg Renlian because he's so jacked. But man, Brody can he can hack you for sure. So that's a little scary.
Yeah, no thanks. I think Greg Renlian might let it go at some point, and I do not believe Brody Merrill would ever let it go.
They both are extremely competitive and still have that in their mentalities. And then PLL did a great job. I thought the reveals of the Wholesome Family videos were a nice touch as well. So that'll do it for this PLL Happy Hour podcast. And we appreciate you making it to the end of the podcast. You loyal fans, I can't believe you made it all the way to the end again. Look at you. Look at what you did. For next time, I'm Kevin Brown alongside Rosie. Catch us wherever you get your podcast, leave a review, share with a friend, and we'll be back either this week or maybe we'll take a bye too. We'll keep you on your toes. Find out. Check back. See you later.